This morning, I will be reading from John 10, 11 through 18, and 1 John 3, 16 through 24. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father. And then 1 John 3:16 through 24. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. This is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence. If our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. Dear friends, if our hearts do not condemn us, we have confidence before God and receive from him anything we ask, because we keep his commands and do what pleases him. And this is his command, to believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and to love one another as he commands us. The one who keeps God's commandments lives with him, and he in them. And this is how we know that he lives in us. We know it by the Spirit he gave us.
Several weeks ago, when Gary found out that I was attending Mennonite Church USA executive board meetings and also constituency leader council meetings, he asked me if I'd have a sermon on it. My first thought was, it's going to be really boring if you listen to me talk about 3 days worth of meetings. So I'm going to condense it very quickly and then try to tie it to the scriptures that we've had today. So almost 2 weeks ago, I attended this joint gathering of Mennonite Church USA Executive Board, Agency Leaders, and Constituency Leaders Council at Dock Mennonite School, located in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. I learned that this joint type of meeting has not occurred since 2014, which surprised me because when I was moderator of PNMC, Pacific Northwest Mennonite Conference, we had been meeting fairly routinely as a larger group. The purpose of these joint meetings afforded the leaders of the church time and space to listen to what's happening in various congregations, conferences, and within the agencies. Part of our agenda was to discuss and discern how the CLC and executive board policies reflect our current realities, clarifying the eldering function of CLC to the board, and whether any changes needed to be made to those policies. Together, we also reviewed the Journey Forward project that was shaped out of the Orlando 2017 Journey Forward Summit. Several from AMC were involved in that process, Nate and Kathy and I, and there might have been others, but I don't recall. We received a report from the sexual abuse panel with several ideas that I've already taken to our leadership team for processing on how we can provide safe and healthy environment here at the church. And the CLC was tasked with reviewing a policy on executive board staff appointments in the hope of clarifying whether persons in a committed same-sex relationship could be appointed to leadership positions in the denominational positions. And then each of us, the executive board and the CLC, also held individual meetings to process our own agenda items. We said goodbye to Irvin Stutzman as the executive director in a formal reception on Friday evening. Saturday morning, the executive board officially welcomed Glenn Guyton, the first person of color who will be serving as the executive director to the executive board and to the national denomination. So what does all this have to do with our scripture today? Well, you might not think there's very much there, but I found a few things, I think. At the local congregation and at the national level, difficult conversations stir up emotions, perhaps causing one to wonder what the future of the church is going to look like. It's a bit like walking through the valley of the shadow of death sometimes. As leaders, we often feel that way. Relying on the image of the Good Shepherd in this morning's scriptures can shape our responses to difficult conversations. In my short journey of life so far, 63 years so far, I recall a number of difficult conversations and changes that have occurred over the years and shaped the church as we know it today. In my 7th, 8th, and 9th grade years, I remember numerous discussions with my parents, my youth leaders, Lee and Ruth Lehman, and the parents of other young people on the topic of women wearing the head covering. We were supposed to wear this head covering to show submission to our fathers or to our husbands and to God. I don't recall when the girls in our youth group decided to quit wearing our prayer coverings, perhaps in my 9th grade year, but I do remember that a number of adult women joined us in solidarity. Another thing that I remember was the general conference, and this was before the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Conference existed, met at Turner, Oregon in 1969. I had to call the archivist and the historian of the conference to confirm that date, 1969. I was in the 9th grade at the time. The conference was on the issue of the Vietnam War and our response to the militaristic call for participation in that war and how the church might respond to those who were avoiding the draft. I remember a lot of shouting going on. That's what I remember as a 9th grader. It didn't seem very hopeful to me as a young person. In the 1970s through the 1980s and even longer, the topics of women in ministry, divorce and remarriage were widespread conversation throughout local churches and the denomination. More recently, in the last 20 years, the church has been discerning how to welcome or if to welcome all persons, specifically those whose sexual orientation is not heterosexual, to full participation in worship and congregational life. What does that mean? In 2002, we saw the merger of the General Conference and the Mennonite churches, with the Conservative Conference pulling away from this new entity. And even recently, we have seen Lancaster Conference and others disassociate from Mennonite Church USA. Why do I mention these painful times in our history? Is there any point in remembering our history? How have our responses shaped the gospel message of the church throughout time? What does any of this have to do with the Journey Forward project, or for that matter, a report on the sexual abuse panel or anti-racism efforts in the church? We often dwell on painful times, but I'd like to ask this question. Where have we seen God's goodness resulting from these painful periods in the church? With many of the issues, the church has grappled with how to present the gospel and how to extend God's kingdom to the world. One of the ways the church has responded over the last 500 years is to create a document that becomes our go-to manual. This slide shows a timeline from about 15, and I forgot the exact year, 1500, the Schleichheim Confession that had 7 points, and how it has changed over a 500-year period. And on the far left corner is the current Confession of Faith written in 1995. The church has a history of writing documents, and these documents became important extensions of how we did church together. Some of the language was exclusionary. Part of the language is in the form of commands. Most of the language tried to explain our interpretation of the Bible for that time and place. And the most current document, as I said, is the Confession of Faith, 1995. The church has a history of building on previous documents. Unfortunately, it doesn't take long for these documents to seem to be cast in stone rather than used as a guide. Some conferences in our meetings this last 2 weekends ago asked whether the journey forward will, asked whether the Journey Forward project will replace the Confession of Faith. And I think there was maybe some hope of that. But the answer was, actually, the Journey Forward is building on our previous documents. We don't know what that means because the church will be participating in creating those documents that come out of the Journey Forward project. It's meant to open conversation of where God is calling the Mennonite church in the 21st century to broader participation across the whole church. At Orlando 2017, MCUSA committed to creating study materials to use in the local congregation. The Pathways study materials is a result of that, and it's nearly complete, and it will be available in June. And here at AMC, the Education Committee has already planned that the Adult Sunday School will be studying these materials this fall. The hope is that the congregations will provide feedback to conference leaders and then eventually to denominational leaders. One of the outcomes of the writing team so far of the Journey Forward is a one-page document called Renewed Commitments for MCUSA. It broadly explains who we are and what we believe. I have already posted those documents and the frequently asked questions on the back bulletin board, but just briefly, here is part of this. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But on this journey together, we commit to following Jesus, witnessing to God's peace, and experiencing transformation. It's a one-page document meant to be easily read and used and referred to, and it's not a big manual that we go back to like many years ago we would have done. We are in this journey forward, we are called to confession, to connection and commitment to others, to witness to God's peace, and that each of us are called to be transformed by God's Spirit. In my mind, one of the key questions we might ask is, how does the church respond to society in gospel fashion? Our experience of Jesus as the Good Shepherd reflects on how we live out our faith in our family, our church, our congregation, and our community. The church has gone through many times of walking through valleys and going up mountains. Now, when we think of valleys and mountains, what do we often think of? Especially when we think of Psalm 24 that we read this morning. I'd like to see a show of hands. Do you think of valleys as times when you're depressed or struggling and that the mountains might be the high tops and the place of a high experience in life? If you agree with that view of the valleys and the mountains, raise your hand. Okay. How about an alternative view? What if the valleys are like the green pastures that the Psalm 23 also mentions? What if the valleys are like the Willamette Valley? Fields, gardens, productivity, and mountains are the places that are frozen, impassable, windblown, and without life. Does anybody relate to that image of mountains and valleys? Okay, some of us. That's my view also. I find mountains to be impassable. Does the way we view these mountains and valleys in our lives or in our church affect how the Good Shepherd leads the church? Does our view affect how the Good Shepherd leads the church? Or is it our perception? How do we as a church respond to society in gospel fashion? And what do I mean by that? In John 10, that was read earlier, Jesus reveals that he's the Good Shepherd, and that's correct. It's the same story that was written in Psalm 23. Jesus knew that psalm just as well as we do. But he goes on to say that he knows his sheep and his sheep know him. Previously, Jesus implied that he was the Good Shepherd. It was the first time he explicitly called himself the Good Shepherd. Then the next shocking thing that he says is he has sheep that are not in the sheep pen and that they will listen to his voice as well. In the cultural aspect of that time, we would be considered to be the sheep that were not in the sheep pen. You see, we are, in Jewish terms, Gentiles. We were not included. I'm also aware that by me standing here today and that my participation here is the result of some painful experiences the church has discerned their way through. It was a deep, dark valley for me personally. If it had not been for John Willems and my parents, I would not be here fully participating in church today. At the time of my divorce in 1989, it was not common for the church to accept divorced and remarried persons and to fully participate in the fellowship. I believe that the church has grown because of the acceptance of persons like me and others who have struggled with long-held traditions that marriage should be for life. One way for us to look at this is that for every difficult conversation the church has held, there have been evidences of God's goodness to the church as doors open to possibilities for growth. That for the understanding of our foundation, that our foundation is Jesus Christ, the stone that the builders rejected. There's a verse in Psalm 118:22 that says, "The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this, and it's marvelous in our eyes." The notes on that verse say that the stone, which was disdained or discarded by the worldly power, has become the most important stone in the structure of a new order that God is bringing about. In fact, Jesus applied that verse to himself in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Peter and Paul also applied the stone to Jesus in Ephesians and in 1 Peter. Okay, so what? If Jesus is the cornerstone or the capstone, the very thing that holds up the space above our doors or secures the foundation of a building, what does that mean for the church and our conversations about any kind of emotional topic that we take up? In scripture we read today, we hear Jesus call himself the Good Shepherd and that he would lay down his life for his sheep. In 1 John 3:16, we read, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters." John goes on to urge the reader to not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. These words are contrary to how the world, history, nation states, even our churches and societies have operated. In these verses, Jesus and John call us to give up our passionate debates on emotional topics, topics that often contain voices of those who have power and want to keep the power, and those who do not have power. When we observe these power structures, I find it interesting. When we observe these power structures, the voices of marginalized are often ignored or trampled upon. What is interesting is that the current issue of the Leader magazine, this one, which is a magazine that's published by Menno Media for lay leaders and pastors to use, it's devoted to the topic of conflict, and there's a number of articles in there about how we maneuver and manage through conflict. For each of the conflicts that I named above, the real conflict was rooted in the source of power. Who had it, who held it, and those who didn't, couldn't or didn't deserve it. What we need to learn from each generation and in each generation is that people were not created to be coerced, dominated, controlled, or abused. They were made to love and be loved. So, how does the church respond to the needs around us in gospel fashion? Jesus presented a view that the sheep pen did not contain all his sheep, that there were others who would listen to his voice. Jesus uses the imagery of being a gate for the sheep, in that whoever enters into the sheep pen enters through Jesus, and Jesus says they will be saved. Isn't that our mission? That we are meant to go out through the open gate and gather others back toward the open gate? We are invited to Jesus and the community that gathers around him. Our relationship with him determines both our identity and the identity of our community. In this passage, anyone who follows Jesus is depicted as a member of the flock. There are no outliers in the flock that follow him. The community that gathers around Jesus are the ones who share in the mutual knowledge of God and Jesus, whose relationship to Jesus is modeled on Jesus' relationship to God. Jesus and God were in union with each other, and Jesus invites us to community and union with him, with God, and with others. What's interesting about this passage is that when the community gathers around Jesus, it receives its identity through Jesus' gift of life for them. So, to be a member of Jesus' flock or herd, what do you call a group of sheep? Is it a herd or flock? Flock of sheep, okay. It's to identify as one of those whom Jesus was willing to die for. In the freely chosen act of his death, Jesus shows the way to life by being the gate and offers abundant life by the example of his love, that is, by him being the shepherd. It's important to note that Jesus says that he lays down his life for the sheep, not his sheep. I never noticed that distinction before. In my mind, that means all of us. Jesus' love is inclusive, not an exclusive gift of life. Jesus makes the love of God fully available by expressing that love in his death. His death seemed like a real low point for the disciples, but it became the high point or the cornerstone for the way, the early church. Jesus held the power to choose to lay down his life or to keep on living. So I wonder, what does it mean for the church to live as Jesus' sheep? How do we express an inclusive gift of love? How do we use our power? Perhaps it's time to consider that power in and of itself is not a bad thing, or that perhaps it's not an opposite to our shared Anabaptist love of servanthood. Perhaps Jesus showed us how to use power by blessing others, by healing others, sharing his good news with all who would listen. Perhaps it takes more power to love with our actions and bless with our words and invite life-giving opportunities for all who want to follow Jesus. Perhaps we need to learn from that example. Perhaps we can use that example as we work together through our covenant celebration. And as you heard from Phil, on May 20th, we will be celebrating a covenant together. The worship committee and the leadership team have had numerous conversations, probably over several years actually, about what it means to worship here at AMC and what it means to be a member. Are they one and the same? Is there a difference? My hope is that through our conversations around commitment, that the May 20th celebration will allow flexibility and grace to grow together and to review and live out the intentions of our work together. My hope is that our covenant documents don't become cast in stone like some have held earlier church documents. My hope is that this experience becomes a high point for our congregation. My hope is that we seek to learn from each other and from Jesus as we work out the gospel message for our time and our place. My hope is that this gospel message will go before us surround us, and walk with us as we go through valleys and over mountains.